DNA evidence in halacha and Jewish law is obviously a particular case of the general question of forensic evidence in Jewish law, which in turn is a special case of the general topic of evidence in Jewish law. Now, obviously, evidence in general is something that's been discussed robustly from biblical times, from the Talmud, way down to contemporary times. There isn't, of course, a whole lot of literature on DNA evidence before about 50 years ago because the techniques didn't exist. Actually, before DNA testing, they did have other types of blood typing, blood type testing, HLA, and other types of blood typing in the mid-20th century, and followed a generation or so later by DNA testing. So the modern literature begins about 70 years ago or so, but obviously the technology changes relatively quickly. Every few years, it accelerates. So obviously the literature that's most on point is the stuff that's been written in the last decade or two. Just briefly, historically, the most robust, the most important discussion on the use of DNA in Jewish law occurred in the last two decades or so, after the September 11th attacks against the World Trade Center, where people were missing and they wanted to identify remains. So DNA was a major part of the evidence that was being introduced to identify burned and mutilated remains. So some of the most important contemporary literature was penned in response to that tragedy, to that attack. But as we'll see, there is earlier literature, and there is there are precedents that go back to the mid 20th century. And the truth is, there is even one precedent that goes back to the medieval period. Not that they actually had any modern notion of scientific forensics then, but there is actually some type of testing discussed as far back as the 12th century or so. But just to give a kind of framework so we can understand what the discussion is about. So just as the law has different standards of evidence for different types of cases, criminal cases you need certainty beyond a reasonable doubt, civil cases have lower standards, there's probable cause, there are presumptions of various sorts. So just as in the law, different types of cases have different standards that have to be met to reach a legal conclusion, in halacha, in Jewish law, we have a similar arrangement. We have numerous different areas of halacha, of Jewish law, which all have their own standards, and they're often unique, they're often independent of the other ones for what types of evidence we need. So considering where DNA is going to be used in the DNA or forensic tissue analysis in general, there are six or a dozen different areas in Jewish law where DNA has come up. Just to list them briefly, there is criminal justice to convict somebody of a crime. We have one set of standards. Civil cases, the most common one has probably been paternity to determine. So paternity in Jewish law has numerous consequences. One of the most heavily discussed ones, is child support and maintenance. To force a putative father to maintain a child, we have to establish that he is indeed the father. It's also relevant for the laws of marriages, mamzerus, for bastardy, for different types of Jewish law. It is important to establish parentage and familial relationships. Aguna, the halacha is that if a man disappears, the woman cannot remarry until we figure out what exactly happened to her husband. So often he's presumed dead, but presumptions are often not sufficient for the law of Aguna. We often have to establish, to meet certain halakhic standards to establish death. In the case where you have a body, or you have parts of a body, and you can't recognize them, you don't have a clear face, you don't necessarily know who they are. So one of the methods in the modern era used to establish identity has been tissue testing, whether based on blood earlier or based on DNA testing today. Avelos, mourning. The mourning is something, it's a human need, but it's also governed by halacha. Halacha has its own extensive set of rules for when mourning is mandated by halacha and when not. One of the questions is, again, going to be identity. If a person is missing and uncertain whether he's alive or dead, and you find remains and you want to establish that he is indeed dead, so again, tissue testing, tissue analysis is going to be one of the ways we can determine whether he's alive or dead. Now, it's kind of self-evident, it's intuitively obvious, and halacha indeed reflects this, as we said earlier, that the standards in all these different areas are going to be different. To convict somebody of a crime, certainly a capital crime, the burden of proof is certainly going to be very high. based on, you know, likely or probably, that's not going to cut it. We want to have a pretty high degree of certainty before we convict somebody of a serious crime. In mourning, it's not a big deal, especially if people want to mourn. If we're wrong, then the consequences are not that dire, so the standards might be lower. Aguna, to allow a woman to remarry, to presume her husband dead, has its own set of standards. Actually, somewhat paradoxically, Aguna is a especially interesting case because the pressures are very high on both sides. On the one hand, the allowing a woman to remarry while her husband is still alive is considered a very, very serious breach of Jewish law, a major sin. So on the one hand, we have an impulse to require a very high standard of evidence. On the other hand, the tragedy of having a woman tied up, chained, not being able to go on with her life, is considered intolerable also. So we have a countervailing impulse to find leniencies. So the Aguna is unique in that respect, that there are very, very strong pressures on both sides, and the vast literature on Aguna is to try to find that line, what's considered acceptable evidence and what's not. Much of the contemporary literature, post September 11th literature on DNA and forensic testing, as I said, has occurred in the context of the Aguna of the World Trade Center. To go briefly through some of the historical precedents that we have, obviously not many that are closely on point, but just to go through some of the historical background on tissue testing and for the purposes of halacha, I mentioned there is one medieval precedent. That is a very curious passage in the Sefer Hasidim, the Book of the Pious, by Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid, a German, very interesting, very creative German thinker in the 12th century or so. He relates the following anecdote. Now, the purpose of this was not to argue for the halachic reliability of tissue testing at all. The purpose was just, he's making the point, the kind of the moral point, the philosophical point, that blood is thicker than water and that parents have a very close affinity to their children, and arguing that a person should properly mourn and commemorate the passing of a parent. We do that today with Kaddish, with other things. So as proof of this, as a kind of vivid illustration of this, he says, there was once a story, this story sounds like something straight out of the Arabian Nights, he says, there was once a story of a man who traveled far away from home with a fortune and with a young son. I think his wife was pregnant with his future son. He also had a slave, a servant. And when the man died far away in a country where he wasn't that well known, the slave saw his chance. He usurped the master's position. He said, I'm the son of this guy. I'm taking over. He took all the money, and when the guy's true son was born, he threw him out as an imposter. He said, I'm the son, you're nobody. So the son sought justice. This happened in some Arabic country, possibly. So he went to the king, the caliph, whoever he was. The caliph was out of his depth. He didn't know what to do. Had to resolve these conflicting claims. So the caliph sent him to Rav Sadia Gaon, a great leader of Babylonian Jewry at the time. Rav Sadia said, I have a procedure which will help us determine who is the true son and who is not the true son. He said, what we'll do is we will take a little bit of blood. We'll draw blood from each of the two candidates for heir, for the true heir. We will then take a bone from the cadaver of the deceased father. We will dip the bone successively into the two bowls of blood, and we'll see the blood that becomes attracted or absorbed into the bone. He's the one who's related by blood, etzemat, samai, basar, mibsari, blood, like attracts to like, and this was how they were able to establish the true son, who was actually the son of his father and who was the imposter. So it's difficult to derive rigorous halacha from a story like this. A story, it's almost a legend. And again, it isn't being invoked by Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid for any rigorous halachic point. Nevertheless, contemporary authorities looking for some kind of precedent, any kind of precedent for tissue testing in the early period, often point to the story as the only real precedent we have for the utilization of forensic testing of tissue by early sources. Some versions attribute the story to King Solomon even. We know he had other great judicial coups that he figured out how to do, so some say the story happened to King Solomon, but whatever it is, doesn't give us that much to rely on, but this is the one early paradigm we have for forensic tissue testing. Then again, then there's really nothing more on the topic said for about 700 years or so, until, as I mentioned, until we get to the 20th century. And before they had discovered DNA, before they had the technology to work with DNA, there were other factors of tissue they could test, other factors related to blood, different type of antigens in the blood. You know, the science is complex, but again, we're going to gloss over the details of the science. There was science around about a half century ago which allowed... So again, when we discuss forensic tissue testing, there are two types of things we can do. We can try to determine or rule out identity. Are you the person who was at the scene of the crime, or are you not the person who was at the scene of the crime? And then there is relationship. Like in the case of paternity, we wanted to establish, is this person related, the father of this person? Can, if two people can marry or not marry, we want to know if they're related. So there's identity, and then there's relationships. Within each one, within identity and within a relationship, we then have, again, two types of conclusions we can reach. We can prove definitively, yes, this is this person, or this was the person at the crime, this is the father of this child. Or we can exclude, we can rule somebody out. We can say this tissue does not match. You are not the person whose blood was found at the crime, or you are not the father of the child. And then, of course, you can have inconclusive results. So in each case, in each example of the literature, you do have to pay attention to whether we're dealing with proving a positive, with proving a negative. And of course, the degree of certainty you can have is often stronger one way than another. Very often, it can sometimes be much easier to conclusively prove that two things do not match than to prove that two things do match. But again, that has to do with the general question of confidence levels, which we'll return to shortly. So in the mid-20th century, as I said, the question of blood testing became a hot issue in the rabbinical courts of Israel. Now, I mentioned earlier there are, you know, 6 to 12 different types of areas where the tissue testing is relevant. Some are more relevant than others. So, for example, criminal justice, which in the United States today, for example, is one of the most common applications of tissue testing, was not actually so relevant to us from a halachic perspective, for the simple reason that we, the rabbinical court, do not engage in criminal jurisprudence in contemporary times. In Talmudic times, in the time of the Temple, biblical times, of course, the as a sovereign people, we did have our own criminal justice system, and that was practiced, but you know, with the loss of our sovereignty, with the exile, with the diaspora, we have not really practiced classic criminal law for quite some time. Even today, where Israel has its independence, and Israel certainly has a system of criminal justice, that system, for better or for worse, is established based on Western principles, and we the students of Torah do not have as much of a say as we would like in how the country is run. There are the rabbinical courts in Israel, but they deal mostly with civil and personal status questions, so we don't actually have a lot of actual practical halakhic literature on criminal justice questions and tissue testing. What we do have is a lot of questions about personal status and civil questions. So the Israeli rabbinical courts began to discuss, as I mentioned, one of the most commonly discussed cases was paternity. The rabbinical courts were frequently called upon to decide paternity cases. The woman would claim that so-and-so was the father of her child. The man would deny it. So again, before they had modern forensic methods, it would be a he said, she said thing. By the nature of such questions, it was very difficult or impossible to prove who was really telling the truth. But with the advent of modern forensics, it became possible to put science to the question and to get a more or less conclusive result. So the leading of halakhic authorities in Israel grappled with this question: what is the role of forensic tissue testing in halakha? And they reached a fairly divergent set of conclusions. Some were quite favorable, some were strongly opposed. The arguments for or against are very interesting. On a very basic level, the key, most obvious question, of course, is how reliable are these methods? What do the scientists say? How much confidence do they have in the given testing? Now, obviously, these things, as we said before, change from year to year, certainly from generation to generation. So claims that were made about the reliability of testing in 1960 obviously are not particularly relevant today. So underlying most of the debate that they began to have half a century ago is really the question of how reliable these methods were. Halacha, even in civil cases, there is generally a very high standard that has to be met before a plaintiff can prevail even in a civil case. It's not as strict as criminal cases, but there is still a very high standard that has to be met. In general, halacha does not have that much use for circumstantial evidence. In general, we want direct and dispositive proof. The gold standard in halacha is two witnesses. Now, today, you know, this is a problem. Today in law schools, they don't teach that. Today they teach that eyewitness identification is not a particularly reliable method of identification. People are susceptible to suggestion. People have imaginations. People, you know, have conclusions they want to reach. Today, you know, we're not so crazy about eyewitness testimony. Today, we all. That's why you need two. Yes. That's why Winter points out. That's why even the Torah doesn't accept one. The Torah requires two independent.
I'm sorry. Is that okay to ask?
Yeah, sure.
Even with the knowledge that for many of the types of cases for which halakhic law would be called upon, you're not going to have two witnesses for murder. You're not going to have two witnesses to it. So was there a feeling that, you know, this is not something that is a practical?
That's a good question. The practicality, so touch on that in a second. So the kind of the black letter law is that two witnesses are required. Circumstantial evidence is dismissed, certainly in criminal cases. A famous Talmudic account of one of the rabbis of the Talmud, Rabbi Shimon ben Shetach, he once saw kind of the proverbial bloody knife. He saw somebody chasing somebody with a knife. They passed out of his sight for a moment. When he saw them again, when he approached them, he saw a murder victim on the ground, bleeding out. He saw the apparent perpetrator holding a bloody knife. And Rabbi Shimon ben Shetach said, I know and you know, we all know who did this, but basically I didn't see you, so we cannot convict you in Beis Din. So that story has a happy or a just ending where a snake came and bit the murderer and he died. But the halacha seems to be that we don't convict based on that. Now the question that you're asking is this a practical way to run society? And this is a question that has been raised by, you know, this is a long-standing question. There is a famous approach, a medieval approach, that says that no, this was not meant to be the complete system of jurisprudence with which society will be run. This was meant to provide one standard for ultimate fairness, but there's also a situational need for practical laws that have to be supplemented by what the local courts, local legislatures see that society needs. They would have to add rules and have to lower the standards as they saw fit, you know, for the preservation of good order in society. The ultimate justice would require two witnesses, but in the real world in which we live, you know, pragmatism has a say too. That's it's a debated position. It's not clear whether that's normative. You know, we do know historically that Jewish communities did have a fair degree of autonomy over the last 2,000 years since the destruction and the exile, and that they did regulate their own affairs, and they did certainly pass, you know, local ordinances that did give the courts and the investigative bodies powers that exceeded the ones that are strictly allowed by classic black letter Talmudic law. The legal phrase is called Makin Va'unshin Shalom and Hadin. The court has the right to strike and smite and punish in deviation from the law, and the scope of that and how we ensure due process is kept once we're giving them this kind of extrajudicial authority is tricky and complex, and it's a topic for another day. But yes, the fact that if we stick to the strict policies. And the truth is, the Talmud itself has a classic debate about the death penalty, much quoted, where sages in the Mishnah are debating how often, practically speaking, how often they would execute a capital offender. So one of them says that a court that would execute more than one in 7 years is considered a sanguine court, meaning killing too often. One of them says one in 70 years. One of them says, if I would be on the court, we never execute anybody. On that, there was finally pushback. The other rabbi said, "Well, you're promoting murder by allowing people literally to get away with murder. You know, society needs some kind of deterrence." So the Talmud itself is debating realistically how often would these conditions be met. It's hard to, you know, it's hard to compare that to contemporary times. The populations were different. We don't know what the crime rates were, etc. But the basic question, the Talmud itself acknowledges: on the one hand, we have an extremely strong imperative to protect the innocent, to make sure nobody is wrongfully ever convicted. On the other hand, you push that too far and you don't impose any kind of justice and society runs amok. Where to draw the line is very tricky, but as I said, you know, we don't really have a living body of criminal jurisprudence in halacha, so it's difficult to bring actual case studies and actual precedents. That's why I'm going to focus more on the cases that we do have a living tradition on, which are more the civil matters. The civil matters also, as I said, do have a fairly strict standard. Circumstantial evidence is generally not good enough to convict a defendant, to find a defendant in possession of his property. Possession is 9/10 of the law. To find him, we call that muksuk in halacha. To find him liable and to compel him to pay a claim, we generally want absolutely conclusive proof. So the question arose, does DNA satisfy. Now, again, we don't mean a mathematical proof, obviously. The law, what the law means by beyond a reasonable doubt, is always going to be something different from what a physicist or a mathematician might consider beyond any doubt or absolutely certain. But the law and halakha have their own standards, and the question arose as to whether tissue testing before they had DNA met that bar or not. And again, at the root of the debate, it seemed, was a question about how reliable the science really was. It was still the early days. Some more conservative thinkers felt, you know, let's wait and see if this holds up in the long run. You know, let's make sure it's the theory is very nice, but let's make sure that the system, you know, has been around for a few years. Even today, you know, today they have something I think called the Frye test in law, which is something that has to meet generally accepted standards of reliability. And when they started with DNA testing, you know, there were debates and conferences about whether the techniques met those standards. So on the whole, so back in the blood testing days, there was some pretty robust debate about it. There were certain technical and theological objections. One of the strongest proponents of relying on blood testing was the great chief rabbi of Israel, Rabbi Yitzchak Isaac Halevi Herzog, who was also a trained scientist. He was furious. He was vehemently opposed to some of his opponents, Rabbi Uziel, among others, who were reluctant to rely on this testing. He said, it's a great pity, he said. He says, what is this? He says, it's just fact. It's just, it's observable. Go to a lab. They'll show you how it works. It's not debatable, he says. He says, it's a great pity, he says, in our day where science is making great strides and conquering new worlds, that some people are sticking their heads in the sands like a certain bird, he says, and saying, you know, we don't see, we don't know. He was vehemently opposed to those who were, he felt, were taking too reactionary a stance in resisting it. But there actually was a pretty strong faction within halakhic authorities that was reluctant to rely on it. But again, it's difficult to know how many of their objections were ultimately rooted in the fact that they simply didn't trust the technology. It was still new. How many of them would still maintain today, where the science is so much more mature, we have so much more sophisticated techniques. But that was how the debate began about half a century ago in Israel, and things like paternity, both for child support as well as for personal status issues. That's how the debate began. Then as we go on, as the science develops, we then have DNA testing, which is, you know, the science is vastly more refined, infinitely more refined. The techniques are more reliable, more specific. You know, some of the early responses in the 80s, they give figures like, we have a 99.6% confidence, which, you know, 1% or 0.5% is still a significant question. Today, we have, you know, many orders of magnitude higher, 1 in a billion, 1 in a trillion, 1 in a quadrillion. Today, if done right, the confidence that science promises us is so much higher. So the question arose as to whether we can rely on tissue testing for things like Haguna and for other areas in halacha. So for Haguna specifically, to allow a woman to remarry based on presuming the husband dead, there is something of a consensus that we do rely on DNA evidence. Not everyone agrees, and not all authorities consider it absolutely the gold standard of evidence, but most mainstream authorities do consider it an important and significant type of evidence. Some of them give it almost completely probative value. One of the leading contemporary authorities in these areas in Israel, Rabbi Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, has written passionately and eloquently arguing for that it should be accepted. He brings a passage in the Talmud. It says that God's great skill, God's great wisdom, a human artist, he makes a stamp, he has some kind of print, and then he prints. They're all modeled after the same one. They all look exactly the same. God, he made, you know, one human being. He made Adam Arishon and the first man, and every man is different. Everyone looks different. Everyone thinks differently. Says Rabbi Goldberg, and the same applies to DNA. Even though God created Adam and Eve, nevertheless, the great you know, wisdom, the great, you know, innovation of God's creation is that the DNA splits and fragments, and that, you know, no two people in the world are going to have the same DNA. It's a vanishingly small probability that by coincidence two people will have the same DNA. Therefore, it is clearly factually reliable, even though we have no Talmudic precedent for it. It doesn't matter, he said. He makes the point. He says all presumptions established by halacha. Halacha makes assumptions about the percentage of cows that are healthy or not, he says. He says the rabbis didn't do a survey of 4 billion cows. The rabbis took some kind of sample size, whether or not they had modern statistical methods and knew how to calculate exactly what kind of sample size they needed or not to get a certain confidence interval. Whatever it is, he says, the rabbis were clearly extrapolating. They observed the world around them. They took what they felt was a significant enough sample size. They saw patterns and they extrapolated. This is how the world works, he says. So the fact that science has only studied a few hundred, a few thousand, a few million individuals, but clearly they have established rules which are clearly accurate, which are clearly reliable. The science is compelling, much as Rav Herzog says. Therefore, we should wholeheartedly accept the conclusions of science, and we should rely on the DNA evidence to draw halakhic conclusions. The particular case he's talking about is to allow a woman to remarry based on the presumption that her husband is deceased.
Can I just interject for a minute? What language would those that rely on DNA, would they give it, like, would it be like considered a rove, a chazakah?
So those are good questions. Rabbi Winter is referring to the fact that in Jewish law, we have a number of very formal categories of evidence. I mentioned before one of the most intangible ones, that is witnesses, one witness, two witnesses. There are also a number of other words which loosely translate to presumptions of various sorts. There's the word chazaka, which basically translates into a presumption. There's rove. Rove literally means majority. In halacha, it functions as a sort of presumption. The halacha often makes estimations like rove times. This is the way it goes down. So we assume with a certain level of presumption that this is what happened. So these rules are highly formalized. Unlike in law, where very often evidence is left to a jury and the jury has to decide, do we find this persuasive enough to conclude beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant did this, or do we find that by the preponderance of evidence the plaintiff should be entitled to this? Unlike in law, where the rules are, a lot of the rules are left to juries to decide, halacha tends to work a little differently. Halacha assigns fixed values to numerous categories of evidence and expects the judge to apply the rules, and the law has, it's similar, and if you think about it, it's similar to the way the law works with regard to certain other types of evidence and testimony. So for example, the law and halacha both share a certain suspicion toward hearsay. I remember when my wife was taking the bar, I remember one of the things that was driving her crazy was the 63 exceptions to the hearsay rule, everything from excited utterance, which you know from the cop shows and the other things, and to the admission against interest, and the exceptions to the exceptions, and the exceptions to the exceptions to the exceptions, and so on. So halacha also has a rule against hearsay. It's called aid mi pi aid. A witness has to testify what he personally knows, not what he heard from someone else. Halacha also has qualifications and exceptions and to that. So halacha treats most evidence in the same way. It isn't left to the jury to make his own assessment. It's left basically to halachic academics, students of halacha, to find precedents, figure out which category a given piece of evidence, a given type of evidence falls into, and then to apply the rules for that category of evidence. So we have Edim, which are witnesses, we have Rov, which is majority, a kind of presumption, Chazaka, another kind of presumption. So what exactly is DNA? So there is actually some discussion about if we have to pigeonhole it into one of these categories, where should we file it? So when it comes to the law of Aguna in particular, the missing husband, there is a category called Simanim. Simanim has relevance to other areas of Halacha too, but it's most commonly discussed in the laws of Aguna. Typically, if one found a body and one couldn't recognize the face, there was something called a siman, a sign. Still the same word as in modern Hebrew. A sign can mean anything. A sign can mean a scar. A sign can mean a unique hairstyle. A sign can mean he has an extra finger on a hand. A sign can mean he's unusually tall, or he has a tattoo, obviously, and so on. So there's extensive literature on simanim. What kinds are there? How much weight do we give to simanim? So basically, much of the literature in Aguna deals with the concepts of simanim. Roughly speaking, there are, crash course in simanim, there are three flavors: bad, medium, and good. Siman garua, siman beinoni, siman muvak. So a lot of the discussion about DNA consists of debates about whether to classify it as a siman, and if so, what kind of siman. Many of the authorities I mentioned who do rely on DNA evidence for Aguna call it a siman mufak, call it a first-class siman, the gold standard siman. The definitions of these things are not so clearly defined, and the exact definitions would take us into some pretty murky waters. But in terms of precedent, what many of the pro-DNA authorities point out is that before they had tissue typing, they had other types of unique characteristics that people would all be different in, that poskim recognized, that halakhic decisors recognized as being probative. So for example, fingerprints. I don't know how far back the literature on fingerprints goes, but it went certainly before DNA and before blood typing. Again, we can't prove that nobody has the same fingerprints. We've seen, you know, sample size. We've compared a few hundred, a few thousand, a few million, whatever it is. We're pretty sure that fingerprint analysis, when done properly with good prints, yields results to a pretty high degree of confidence. So many posts were willing to rely on it. They had dental records. They had, you know, the shapes of teeth and the shapes of the jaw, which was considered reliable. Today they have, you know, irises and whatnot. So many posts, even before they had, irises is more recent, but many posts, even before they had DNA, were willing to classify some of these various biological features that had been empirically determined to be unique, or to be the probability of coincidence, of collision in the domain being vanishingly small. So many Postkim relied on that. So therefore, when you get to DNA in contemporary times, many Postkim argued that it should fit into the same tradition. There were those who disagreed, and some of those who disagree were doing so along the lines Arbe Winter was raising. They often took a more formalistic, more technical approach. They said, you know, show me exactly which of the formal halakhic categories this fits into, and they argued largely on formal reasons that it didn't quite fit in, and they argued even though they weren't debating the statistics, that the statistics and the science clearly indicated that they were fairly reliable, they argued that we still require certain formal characteristics for the evidence to be admitted. That was one of their arguments. Again, Rav Goldberg did not have patience for this argument. He said, you can't argue with facts. He says, the facts are so overwhelmingly conclusive. The science is so clear. It's so reliable. He says, you know, the technical discussions about how to file, he says, are beside the point. The evidence is so strong that it has to be relied upon. Now, one area in which halakhic authorities were much less willing to rely on DNA evidence is the question of mamzerus. Mamzerus is the law of bastardy in halacha, the halacha that people born, it doesn't mean what it means in English, born out of wedlock, it means people born from certain illicit unions, like adultery. The consequences for the child are quite serious. There are forbidden marriages that this entails. He can't marry such a child, even though it's not his fault, cannot marry ordinary Jews. This creates, obviously, you know, major issues, and it creates, obviously, tremendous hardship for a person who has this status. So the traditional halakhic attitude always was that we try very hard to avoid having to assign the status. Now, again, we follow the rules of halakha, so we don't have unlimited flexibility, but the poskim approach these questions with a strong desire not to end up concluding unnecessarily that someone has the status of a mamzer. As a matter of fact, to see to what extent this goes, Rabbi Mordechai Willig, discussing one of the leading authorities who discussed the World Trade Center, Agunas, when he was discussing DNA, he actually said, wait a second, DNA is very nice when it's useful to us, when it's going to help us solve Aguna problems, but it's going to create big headaches for us for Mamzeris. It's going to uncover cases of Mamzeris which would have been swept under the rug before. Do we really want to do that, he says? Is this a Pandora's box we really want to open? At the end of the day, he says, what are we going to do? If it's valid evidence for Aguna, we have to use it and let the chips fall where they may. But that was actually a concern he had, that we don't want to get too carried away with DNA evidence if that'll cause headaches for Mamzeris. And the truth is, many, many major halakhic authorities have decided that we can be lenient with regard to Mamzeris. I heard a lecture from Rabbi Asher Weiss, a leading expert in Eretz Yisrael, where he, although he was pretty favorable toward DNA evidence in other areas such as Aguna, he argued at length that in an interview, radio interview, he argued at length that we should not rely on DNA evidence for Mamzeris. For this, he marshaled a whole host of arguments. Some of them, even he admitted, were highly speculative. But some of them are quite important, and we should, you know, go through a few of them to get a feel for the halachic arguments for or against.
Does it mean to assign somebody Mamzeris based
yes,
on DNA?
Yes, to assign, yes,
from the
yes, that's an important clarification. DNA, of course, in any of these domains can cut both ways. It can yield the conclusion you want. It can yield the conclusion you don't want. When I speak about the reluctance of authorities to use DNA for Mamzeris, what I mean is reluctance to use DNA to establish Mamzeris where, absent DNA evidence, there would be no need, no basis to reach such a conclusion. So, for example, Rav Yosef Shalom Elyashiv, recently deceased, one of the leading halachic experts in Israel, he was once asked about an allegation made against a child, a person, that he or she was actually a Mamzer. Now, the allegations were such that under the halakhic rules of evidence, they didn't have credibility. We're not going to get into all the rules of Mamzeris, but not every allegation has any halakhic significance. In this case, the allegation would have simply been dismissed as being not supported by any evidence, and it would have had no impact on the child's status. The question was, there was the possibility of doing a DNA test. So maybe that should at least trigger a test. Rav Liashiv said, nope, don't test. According to halacha, the allegation has no formal significance. What we don't know is not going to hurt us. We're not obligated to test. We shouldn't test. We don't go around looking for trouble, he says, and therefore don't test. Now, Rav Liashiv implies that if you do test the test and the test gave you results, you couldn't turn away from those results. Rav Liashiv's position is indeed quoted by a number of authorities as both based on this response as well as other things he said. He did believe that DNA testing did have halachic probative value, but when it came to Mamzeris, he said, don't test. And Rav Asher Weiss is making the same point. His main point is, you know, certainly you shouldn't test, and he's going even further, I think, in saying that the test results will not be dispositive with regard to establishing Mamzeris. We'll consider a few of his arguments, and we'll see whether they would apply to exculpatory testing also, to remove the status of Mamzeris from someone. Some of his arguments will apply, some of them won't apply. He makes a number of different arguments. One of them involves, we mentioned earlier, the question of standard of evidence. How strong evidence do you need? We mentioned that capital cases have the highest standard, by far the highest standard of evidence. We require absolute certainty, two witnesses, that's what you need. Rabbi Weiss argues that Mamzeris is such a serious thing, you're destroying somebody's life by giving him the status. He brings halachic precedent for this, that the standard that we use is the same standard as for capital cases. We require the same level of gold standard, rock bottom evidence that we would require in a capital case. He argues that halacha would not allow DNA evidence to be used in a capital case. That's debatable, but he argues that he argues that this would not suffice for a capital case, which he himself acknowledges is debatable. As I said, we have no real living tradition on the question, but he argues that the normative view is that we would not rely on it for a capital case, and that is the opinion of several other major authorities who have discussed DNA, that, again, it's kind of a theoretical question, but they argue that halacha would not rely on DNA evidence for a capital case. Therefore, Rabbi Weiss says, we would not rely on DNA evidence for Mamzeris either. Now, as Rowinter is pointing out, there are some serious counterarguments to his point. The halacha is, for example, that if a husband is out of town for 12 months and his wife gives birth, then we assume the child is at least a possible mamzer, because we say up to 12 months, we say maybe it was a really long pregnancy, 10 months, 11 months, maybe she had a really, really long pregnancy. Once you hit 12 months, the halacha says, it's so wildly implausible either that the gestation was so long or that he secretly came into town and nobody saw him and he stole out again at the dead of night and fathered a child. That's just so implausible and so unlikely that we have to give the child the status of a mamzer, or at least a doubtful mamzer, a suffix mamzer. The halacha is clear, in other words, that halacha does allow mamzeris to be established based on overwhelmingly compelling circumstantial evidence. So whether we say that such evidence would also be enough for a capital case, and there is such a position in the halachic tradition, or whether we say that the status of the mamzeris does have more relaxed rules in capital cases, I'm not sure. But this is actually a serious problem that Rabbi Weiss has to deal with, which is that it's difficult to say that we absolutely, literally require two witnesses to establish mamzeris. Otherwise, you'd basically never have a case of mamzeris, and the halachic literature clearly does have some cases of mamzeris. So I would like someday to discuss this with him, maybe write to him and ask him to clarify his position.
So is the mother of a child born after 12 months automatically considered to have committed adultery, because that is a capital offense?
That's a very good question. What would the status of the mother be? So certainly we would not actually impose capital punishment on the mother for a few reasons. First of all, because when we deal with the capital crime of adultery, it's not enough to prove that the act occurred. You have to establish intent and consent. So theoretically it could have been rape. We don't know. Even if she's not claiming rape, but she's not claiming anything. So that would be one question. We would have to establish intent. That's a good question. The other issue is simply the one we've been raising, which is the standard for a capital conviction really the same as Mamzeris? There are certainly some arguments to be made that the capital standard is simply higher, that for that you need two witnesses and even strong circumstantial evidence. There are actually, I've been alluding to this, there are actually some sources in the halakhic tradition which indicate that literally 100% solid circumstantial evidence would be enough for a capital conviction. The Tosafists talk about a case of two people in a room, The locked room mystery. Two people are in a room. Nobody else is there. No way in, no way out. One of them comes out. One of them, you knock on the door. One of them is dead. The wound is a bite mark. It was caused by another animal or human. There were no other animals or humans in the room. It was on a part of the body that it couldn't have been self-inflicted. In such a case, there are opinions that where the evidence is literally airtight, then you can actually impose capital punishment. Others disagree. And again, I would point out that you read enough mystery stories, there are a lot of cases that seem airtight, and then you find out that it wasn't so airtight. So the halacha always takes that into account, especially in capital crimes. So it's unlikely that you would ever convict somebody in a case like that. Hasra, Winter points out the need for warning, issuing a formal warning, which again is related to the question of intentionality and whether both as to whether the person knows the law, as well as whether he acted intentionally or by accident. So those are all numerous hurdles that would probably apply, make it difficult or virtually impossible to get a capital conviction, an actual execution for a capital offense. But for Mamzerus, I think the standard clearly is somewhat lower. Just a couple of other points raised by Rabbi Weiss. One of them, and this is one of the key concerns that addresses, that affects all the areas of DNA testing in any type of case, that is the question of science is great insofar as it goes. It's good when it's applied correctly. But in the real world, with fallen humans, there's a lot of human error. Even if the science is perfect, the applied science is often less than perfect. The Reshiva, Rabbi Arnold Piansky, just showed me an article in The Atlantic. I didn't have a chance to go through all the examples and read any rebuttals or anything, but insofar as it's true and a fair article, it was a damning indictment of the way actual courts in the real world have been applying DNA evidence, questions of gross errors in terms of by the technicians. The possibility for contamination is terrible. In one case, there was they had a putative serial killer. They found the same DNA at upwards of 40 crime scenes. Turned out it was someone who worked in the manufacturing plant that produced the DNA swabs that had gotten. In another case, they found they linked somebody to a crime, and they found that the same paramedics who had treated the crime, who had come to the crime scene, had also treated the perpetrator earlier, and they had transferred a little bit of DNA via equipment. So the potential for contamination is tremendous. The potential for operator error. Some of us laymen, we sometimes get awed in the face of science. We think it's all like mathematical proofs, like textbook. In the real world, there are mixtures. There are incompletes. Even fingerprints. There are partial prints. There are mixtures, and the technicians are being called on to give assessments about probabilities, about likelihoods. You rely on the level of their training, you rely on the level of their competence, you rely on the quality of the materials. So in general, even if the science in theory is great, is perfect, is virtually logical proof, but in the real world, we deal more often with shades of gray. So halacha always has to take into account the question of technician error and how reliable the science actually is. Now, obviously, you have to first sort out the facts before you can establish the halacha. Until we decide how reliable are the labs and are the technicians, we can't apply halacha. But Rabbi Jachter himself, Rabbi Chaim Jachter, Rabbi Howard Jachter, is a leading expert, a leading dayan in New Jersey. He was heavily involved in the Basin of America and the World Trade Center. Agunas, he discusses he doesn't deal with the exposés about how bad they are sometimes, but he discusses questions about relying on the system. Does halacha allow for the reliance on technicians who aren't necessarily trusted by halacha? A lot of debate about that too. But in general, that's certainly one piece of the puzzle you have to consider, that beyond the textbook science itself, we have to consider how accurate are the technicians who are actually applying these standards. There's actually this falls into the same category, but there apparently my biology professor friends tell me there's something called the chimera, which is a monster in mythology, but also is caused by mothers and fetuses sometimes. DNA transfers, multiple fetuses can exchange DNA. There were crazy cases that came up. A woman was once going to be convicted on welfare fraud because the child she was claiming, the DNA had claimed, it wasn't a proper match to her, and it turned out it was one of these freakish things where the DNA had shifted from the mother to the child. And so hopefully the point is, once science understands these things, then designs around them, designs tests that are meant to rule out these possibilities, the twin brother kind of case, where twins can share DNA. obviously, and science is not stupid, and science understands these things, and you hope that the science is the science and the applied science is being developed in ways that takes these things into account. But you know, I don't know if it was Yogi Berra, another one of the great, you know, sages of the 20th century, who said, in theory, there's no difference between theory and practice. In practice, there is. So that's the problem you're dealing with, that we have to be sure that in the real world, the techniques really yield such unimpeachable results. Rabbi Weiss goes through a number of other objections to using DNA, particularly in the sphere of mamzerus, just to give you a flavor for how far halachic authorities are willing to go in making speculative arguments to avoid creating mamzerim. Rabbi Weiss, and he admits this is speculative, he brings a midrash. The midrash says that when a man and a woman commit adultery, so God will sometimes create the child, will make him look like the adulterer, because even if they think they're going to get away with it, God wants to show everyone what they did. Why that's fair to the child, we can discuss, but at least to prevent the guilty from getting away with it. And the midrash explicitly continues, this occurs not just when the child is actually born from the act of adultery, even if it's the husband's child, the Midrash says, Midrash Rabbah says, God will sometimes make him look like the sinner in order to expose this faithless couple. Says Rabbi Weiss, if God is really tampering with phenotypes and making them look like people other than their parents, maybe he's tampering with the genotype too, maybe he's messing around in there with the genes too. Who knows what's really going on with the way God runs the world? A very speculative argument, obviously, but it just goes to show how far Poskim are willing to go to, again, I don't think he would apply that rule to Aguna or to other cases. Rabbi Weiss makes one other very interesting argument, specifically with regard to Mamzerus. He says, science is never final. They used to think the world was flat. You know, the smart money was the world was flat. Educated people thought that a long time ago, at least. Then they changed their minds. The evidence showed otherwise. Certainly nobody understood relativity or quantum theory before the 20th century. So science changes. Now, of course, Rabbi Weiss says, Rabbi Weiss is a very wise man. Of course, that does not mean that we're not going to rely on science in applying halacha. Halacha constantly relies on science. Halacha constantly relies on doctors, on expert opinion. That's true. Says Rabbi Weiss, Mamzerus is something which inherently, by its very nature, has a lasting impact. The child of a Mamzer is also a Mamzer. It's a taint that can never or almost never be eradicated. Says Rabbi Weiss, anything which is so final and so permanent in nature, we have to have a higher standard than usual for the application of science. Since science, by its very nature, is subject to change, then who knows what science, and again, you see things like this Atlantic article, that's really the application of the science rather than the science itself. But even things which would be good enough for other areas of halacha, still, when it comes to areas which are so permanent and so final and have such far-reaching consequences, we will be even more reluctant than the normal to rely on science, which by its nature is never the last word. So just a brief summary. So halacha, the literature on tissue testing, forensic testing, goes back about half a century. The attitude of the poskim ranges from skeptical to positive to highly committed to its reliability. A lot of this has to do with the quality of the science, how reliable the science itself A claims to be, B, you know, how much time has passed, how mature the science is, how sure we really are that it's reliable. When it comes to areas like Aguna, areas where, again, where there's a very high, even though, again, we don't want to allow women to remarry improperly, but we also have a very, very strong motivation to allow her to remarry. Most post-Kim, the consensus view is to rely on tissue testing as a strong means of generating a conclusion about identity, typically in Aguna case. When it comes to other areas, such as Mamzerus, where we're much more equivocal, we're much less interested in getting a conclusion, and there are all these other arguments we made, formal halakhic arguments, as well as technical questions about the reliability, Poskim typically are much more reluctant to rely on testing, and certainly much more reluctant to order testing when there isn't any need for it. The halakha often doesn't require you to actually take steps to investigate if you don't actually have a concrete down in front of you. So there, I think the halakha would typically be much more certainly reluctant to order a test, and even somewhat reluctant to rely on evidence generated by such a test.